Welcome back to the second hour of Issues Etc. Still on the bestsellers list, Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code, kind of walks the line, or at least claims to walk the line, between fiction and fact. In fact, at the heading of several chapters, there are statements of fact, or at least purported statements of fact, and we are going to try and evaluate a few of those. We certainly can't evaluate all of them, but we'll get an evaluation in general here at the outset in our conversation with Dr. Ronald Huggins of Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. If you haven't read this book, you've probably been living under a rock, or maybe you've just heard about it and decided it wasn't your cup of tea. Either one, it is one of those books that people are reading, and if I'm not mistaken, I think that... who's the big Hollywood director there, Craig, that's going to be doing Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code as a film?
Is it Ron Howard?
Ron Howard. Thank you very much, Craig. My memory on the other side of the boards here, Ron Howard's planning, at least planning, in the planning stages of putting this thing on film. And then, of course, we'll have to be responding to it all over again. Dr. Ronald Huggins joins us here in just a moment for a review of Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code here on Issues Etc. After our conversation with Dr. Huggins, open lines for the next hour of the program. We'll hear from Tim LaHaye on the release and the second printing even before it hits the shelves of The Glorious Appearing. The Left Behind series has been going and going and going and going. Tim LaHaye has some things to say about its success, its sales, and what he plans to do next. We'll hear from him during open lines. Get your reaction to that as well. It always strikes me as just humorous that it takes 12 books to do 7 years of a supposed tribulation. And then when he decides to write a book about the what he believes to be the thousand-year millennial reign of Christ, he's going to try and pack it all into one book. Maybe a thick book, but it'll all pack into one book, according to Tim LaHaye. We'll hear from him during open lines, plus some other things to talk about as well. And then Uwe Suminetto joins us, religion editor for United Press International. We'll get a religion roundup with him in the last 25 minutes of the program, and we'll talk to him about the general lack of Muslim outrage to the killings and mutilations in Fallujah last week. Dr. Ronald Huggins is an assistant professor of theological and historical studies at Salt Lake Theological Seminary. He's author of several essays on the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Apocryphal Gospels, and other apocryphal works. He's also written a two-part review of the Da Vinci Code titled Cracks in the Da Vinci Code. Dr. Huggins, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
For those who have not read Dan Brown's novel, give us a rundown of its storyline and its claims and your evaluation of those claims.
Oh, well, it's a very exciting novel. I enjoyed reading it. I, of course, didn't agree with the historical premises of it, which were that Jesus was married and had to Mary Magdalene, who was also one of his favorite apostles. They had children who then later became the kings of France. And, well, the story, if I tell too much, I'll give it away. But it's a very exciting story. Historically, it is very poorly done, which is not really that surprising for these kind of novels, except that in the beginning of the book, he makes the claim all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. Now, had he not done that, I wouldn't have written any articles.
And it would be classified as pure fiction, in other words.
Very pure fiction. He derives a lot of his material from conspiracy books that have been floating around for some years, but certainly not any historical validity.
I guess, how do you account for its raging success in the book-buying and reading public, aside from the fact, of course, that it has an exciting plot?
Well, I mean, this is a question. One, I'd say it is a tremendously exciting book. Have you read it?
Yes.
It moves along at a pace that's just breakneck, much faster than a lot of its competitors. Secondly, it taps into widespread prejudices, I think, against Catholicism. There's a book by Philip Jenkins called The New Anti-Catholicism, published by Oxford University Press 2003, which really shows that this is, as his subtitle says, the last acceptable prejudice, although I wouldn't say it's the last acceptable prejudice. Certainly, evangelicals get tied in there, too. But also it has the interest of exposing the hidden story, the true story behind what everyone has heard from the Gospels. And so it has kind of that, feeds the hankering for being an insider, having inside knowledge, and so on. So those are a couple of things, anyway.
You mentioned in the first part of your review of Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, not only the more recent conspiracy-type works from which he draws, but there's also, he claims to draw from apocryphal and pseudepigraphal works of more ancient pedigree. Tell us about some of those.
Well, he focuses, he says, you know, one of his characters, he has him pull out a book, and it says Gnostic Gospel, or I think it says Gnostic Gospels on the cover, and he says these are the Gospels from the Dead Sea Scrolls and from Nag Hammadi, and they're earlier than the biblical Gospels. Well, these are ancient documents. However, the Dead Sea Scrolls have to do exclusively with ancient Jewish text, and the Gnostic Gospels are certainly not as early as the New Testament Gospels. The Gnostic texts are from the mid-4th century. So those are a couple of things. He features one in particular, the Gospel of Philip, where he tries to find Mary Magdalene described as Jesus' sexual partner.
And he makes much of this, of course, without giving away too much of the plot of the Da Vinci Code, that Mary Magdalene, what is the basic idea here, that Mary Magdalene is chief among the apostles, contrary to the New Testament texts, that she is also the wife, mother of children of Jesus, and the one with whom Jesus would have continued his legacy? Is that the basic outline here?
Yeah, he claims that Mary is the grail and not the cup, Last Supper cup, and so she preserves the royal line of the blood of Jesus. And that the idea that Mary Magdalene was a prominent apostle in the early church is held by a few quite liberal scholars, Karen King in particular, Harvard University, and she bases her claims on a gospel, a 4th-century gospel called the Gospel of Mary. However, she herself is on record just dismissing the Da Vinci Code's use of the Gnostic text in terms of their historical value.
How do you evaluate these pseudepigraphal writings, the Gnostic Gospels, that claim to be of Thomas or Philip or Mary, aside from their late date? In terms of their content, do they bear any resemblance in factual ways to the 4 canonical Gospels?
Well, certainly they bear some resemblance because most of them are mock-ups built upon the canonical Gospels. One thing that's interesting, Dan Brown claims that at the Council of Nicaea in 325, the Orthodox Christians made Jesus into a god. What's interesting there, and then the implication is that these Gnostic Gospels presented him simply as a man. But actually, the fact is, the Gnostic Gospels never admitted that he actually became a human being. Rather, they had him only appear to be human. One of the Gnostic texts has him hanging on the, or laughing as a substitute's hanging on the cross. Others show Jesus on the cross not suffering, making specific mention of that, because he really wasn't human. And so it's just kind of an ironic reverse of fact that Dan Brown has there.
We're talking with Dr. Ronald Huggins, getting his review of Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. He is an assistant professor of theological and historical studies at Salt Lake Theological Seminary. Now, if you have a question or a comment on The Da Vinci Code, give us a call now at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Huggins, let's talk about 2 pieces of artwork from The Brush of Leonardo da Vinci, hence the name of the novel, wherein Dan Brown purports to see, or the characters in his novel purport to see, evidence of Mary Magdalene's marriage to Jesus, of her ascendancy among the apostles, beginning with the more famous The Last Supper. What do the characters there in that novel claim to see in that piece of artwork?
Oh, well, they claim to see Mary sitting there at Jesus' right hand. They say she's wearing a gold necklace, and you can discern a hint of bosom, he says, and that there that Peter is standing by making a threatening gesture towards her neck, and also that there's this disembodied arm holding a dagger. I mean, these are the claims, presumably that there's one extra arm in the picture.
And if you actually look at the restored paintings or earlier restorations of Da Vinci's The Last Supper, what do you really see?
Well, the moment of the in which Leonardo was representing was the moment right after Jesus said, "One of you is going to betray me." And what you have is you have Peter leaning forward, sort of speaking behind his hand, vaguely pointing towards Jesus, asking, ask him who it is. And then, of course, in the next moment, John leans over to Jesus and says, "Who is it, Master?" And he says, "Well, the one who dips the bread in the wine with me, that's the one who's going to betray me." And so you see Judas in that same pair of group of figures with the money bag in one hand and his hand hovering over the bread in the other. As for the arm, it is not holding a dagger. It's a one-edged knife used for cutting. It's not at all thin enough to be a dagger. And it's actually Peter's arm that's holding it. There are sketches that Leonardo did in preparation, which are named Peter's Arm, or Sketch for Peter's Arm.
So in other words, we can go back to Leonardo's Da Vinci's peace studies before he actually did this monumental work and see precisely what he intended to paint, apart from what we can find by way of restoration of the painting.
That's certainly true. There's one of the things that that Dan Brown points out is that John looks sort of effeminate. Well, this is traditional for John. He's a young man. You can see in several, not that he looks effeminate, but that he's, you know, he has no beard, that he has often light and curly hair. And so there are sketches that Leonardo did off earlier work, sort of in the planning of his own. There's one particularly by Andrea del Castagno, where it's clear that Leonardo intends to include John among the 12 and that this is really not Mary Magdalene at all.
Does Dan Brown in the Da Vinci Code ever explain, at least in this painting, and Da Vinci supposedly giving out the secret in an oblique way of what has been hidden by the church since Constantinople, does he ever explain the absence of John from this group of apostles?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question that I really hadn't even thought about.
I mean, it seems that if you're going to purport the presence of Mary and you have an undisputed 12 at this point, you've got to explain where John was or where one of them was. I mean, you could assign John to a different character, I suppose.
Well, you know, he, as far as I know, he didn't make any effort in that way, and I haven't seen his main source is Prince and what's her name? Picknett's book, The Templar Revelation. And I don't recall seeing in any of those descriptions any attempt to explain why he'd leave John out.
There is another piece of artwork from Da Vinci's brush that is mentioned in Dan Brown's novel along with The Last Supper, and that is Madonna on the Rocks. In fact, one of the characters in the novel claims that there's a similar threatening gesture as Peter is supposedly making in The Last Supper painting in this painting, Madonna on the Rocks. How accurate is that?
Well, you know, that's there is one historian who actually saw the hand as slightly menacing in there. I don't see it. No other art historians have seen it. One of the most striking things of that description is that Da Vinci Code mistakes Jesus for the figure of John the Baptist and John the Baptist for the figure. Actually, the angel Uriel, who's the one who's supposedly making that threatening gesture, is pointing at John the Baptist, which the iconography is a little confusing. Leonardo did two versions of that painting. The question would be, why would the baby Jesus be sitting by the angel Uriel, and John the Baptist sort of under the arm of Mary. Well, later on, the second version, Leonardo puts in all the additional symbols that identify the figures more exactly. John shows up in his little camel skin with his cross, and making it clear that probably John is some representative of the faithful, and therefore Mary, as the mother of the church, has her arm around John. But in both cases, the angel is really pointing, not doing any threatening gesture. Oh, it was. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. Actually, it's Mary's hand that's supposed to be making the threatening gesture.
Well, it's supposed to be like the angel's, at least according to Dan Brown's interpretation.
Oh, you're right.
Mary's got her hand in kind of a gripping fashion. I looked at the painting before
right.
we came on the air, and Mary's hand is a little, the fingers are curled, and she's supposedly holding an invisible head that the angel is making kind of the sign
yeah,
to.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, and you saw the hand, and that hand has been described as by one historian, I correct myself, as looking like an eagle's talon, which I didn't see at all. Looked like maybe a bit clumsy foreshortening, but that's the most I can make of it. I didn't imagine any kind of invisible head or neck or anything like that. Did you see something like that?
No, absolutely not. It just looks like Mary is kind of caught in a moment. And I think the angel Uriel is obviously pointing at the child rather than making any other kind of gesture.
Yeah. Certainly it's a stretch. I don't know why that one historian saw Mary's hand as menacing.
You mentioned in your review, Dr. Huggins, that Dan Brown seems to be operating with a view of Leonardo da Vinci's painting, The Last Supper, that does not have the benefit of the most recent restoration. Tell us about that.
Well, that is a fact. In fact, he doesn't seem to be aware of it, and this, again, is probably his dependence on the 1997 book, The Templar Revelation, and the new restoration was completed only and revealed in 1999. So, for example, the hint of the bosom, which may have been in some over-fertile imagination seen in the fold of John's cloak, you can look on the other side where there is no cloak, there's just his shirt or frock or whatever, and there's no hint of a bosom there. So the authors of the Templar Revelation had seen this hint of a bosom. Well, after the cleaning, then the next book by one of the Templar Revelation's author says, well, there is a smudge where the bosom was. So now she expects that bosom was removed. But Dan Brown still is putting forward what she and her co-author had mentioned in the other book. And another point, I think, which is more important, is that they represent Peter as making a menacing gesture towards Mary Magdalene, the John figure, sort of a knife-like hand ready to cut her throat. Well, this was admittedly smeared in the earlier version before the restoration, but if you look at it now, since 1999, you see that it's really a relaxed gesture and sort of pointing towards Jesus. Now, this was evident already in early copies of Leonardo's work, and once you'd seen the copies, you could see, even in the smudge, what Peter's hand was doing in the older photographs. But now it's clear that certainly isn't the case.
Dr. Huggins, as you read Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code, did you find that his errors with regard to facts pertaining to these paintings we've been talking about are indicative of his errors regarding the other facts in the novels?
Well, yes, I did. I mean, I found that wherever I had personal knowledge of the information he was talking about, I was immediately aware that he was not speaking accurately. Places where I didn't have any knowledge, of course, he may have appeared at times more credible, but that may be that I just didn't have any knowledge.
With only about 2 minutes here before we go, What are your deepest concerns about Dan Brown's novel, and how would you warn the person who's just now perhaps finding it in the bargain bin at the bookstore, picking it up, having heard all of the buzz, and reading it for the first time?
Well, I mean, I don't have a great concern, partly because these things come and go like, the winds. They're a flash, everyone's excited, everyone's explaining how they now know the truth, and then they're gone and waiting for the next conspiracy novel to come along. But I would, urge whoever reads it, really, that they have to understand that this is just a popular novel. Dan Brown apparently put stock in these conspiracy books. I don't doubt his personal integrity in quoting them as credible sources, but I do doubt very seriously, and I think everyone who reads that should know, that he doesn't have, if that's the case, he doesn't have any real sense of history at all.
Dr. Ronald Huggins, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Well, Todd, I appreciate it, and thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Ronald Huggins is Assistant Professor of Theological and Historical Studies at Salt Lake Theological Seminary. He's authored several essays on the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Apocryphal Gospels, and other apocryphal works. He's also written a two-part review titled Cracks in the Da Vinci Code. When we come back from this break, open lines for your questions and your comments. By the way, you can read that review by Dr. Huggins at irr.org, irr.org. Open lines follows this break. We're going to hear from Tim LaHaye. His latest, The Glorious Appearing, 12th in the Left Behind series, selling so briskly that even before the first printing was delivered to the retail outlets, the second printing was called for. Okay, we don't want to begrudge him his literary success. He's obviously established that in the publishing community. We'll hear what Tim LaHaye has to say about the latest novel, about his plans for the future, and about the general success of the Left Behind series. Many believed it would never get here, but it's here, The Glorious Appearing. What follows next, we'll find out from Tim LaHaye. We'll take your questions and your comments, and as usual during open lines, it's anything you want to talk about. I have a couple of the things to walk over to during open lines as we converse back and forth via the telephone lines. Let's see, what else do I have to talk about here? Oh, yes. I do want to commend, if we have time there, Rick Warren, who in light of our earlier conversation with Dr. Jean Adler-Veith, at least according to the press accounts, has his priorities straight. He has a new book that's supposed to come out too, a sequel to The Purpose-Driven Life. Now in its what? This has got to be in its 62nd week on the New York Times bestsellers list. He's put off the sequel to take care of his ailing wife. And that deserves commendation. He's putting his priorities and his vocations in the proper order. We'll talk about that during open lines, among a few other things as well. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Give us a call in the next hour. We'll talk with Uwe Simonetto in the last 25 minutes of the program from 5:30 to 6. But the next hour is all for you, your questions, your comments. We'll hear from Tim LaHaye. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In true Christian worship, God always acts first. He descends from heaven through His Word and sacraments, bringing us sinners healing. It's the healing of the forgiveness of sins won at the cross by Jesus Christ our Savior. He heals our guilt, our depression, our grief. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for April is called They Will See His Face, Worship and Healing. You can order They Will See His Face by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. You can also go online to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and find information about this book. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, They Will See His Face, Worship and Healing. 1-800-325-3040.
Answer to that immediately.
I'm looking for
as many opinions and ideas and references in all this regard as I can. Your truth.
You want to give a gift to AM850KFUO? Great! We've made it very easy. Just visit our website at kfuo.org. Click the support button on the left of the page, complete the form, and click submit. You can make a one-time single gift or a monthly gift using the KFUO website. So visit our website today at kfuo.org. And thank you for supporting AM850KFUO.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Results of a new study sponsored by the National Institutes of Health indicate that children as young as 12 months old are influenced by what they see on TV. In the study, children watched TV and observed people reacting negatively or positively to certain objects. After watching the program, the children were then given these objects. Even at 12 months old, the babies tended to avoid those objects that were associated with negative behavior on TV. This is just one more study added to the growing mountain of evidence that shows TV does influence our children. But the good news is that Jesus can be a greater influence on our children. When you turn off the TV, read Bible stories to your children and remind them of Jesus' love. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute at www.cmli.org.
We know that you spend a lot of time listening to us on AM850 KFUO, but we need to listen to you as well. To find out how to call, write, or email the staff of AM850 KFUO, go to our website, kfuo.org, click on the contact link. There you'll find the whole staff, our phone numbers, and a way to email us. Always feel free to contact us and keep listening to AM850 KFUO.
How does worship heal anxiety, guilt, loneliness, and grief? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for April deals with worship and healing. It's titled, They Will See His Face. You can find out more by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Or you can browse before you buy, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. They will see his face.
Weather for St. Louis, partly cloudy tonight, low near 50, and for tomorrow, mostly cloudy, high near 72. Right now in St. Louis, it's mostly cloudy and 62. Pastor Todd Wilkin comes your way next with an hour of open lines, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727.
Oh my goodness, it's so gratifying to work with such professionals. In a pinch, he pulls out this, he's got weather. I think he even tossed a little traffic in there. Now I know how to get home with the president in town throwing out the first pitch. It is a little disturbing to go up against the president and opening day and a home game of the Cardinals in a first hour of Issues, etc. Now we're headed through the middle of the second and into the third with open lines for your questions and your comments. We've talked about several books. We talked about Dan Brown's the Da Vinci Code just a few minutes ago. We're going to be talking here during open lines and hearing from the author of the Left Behind series, books. And this is the time of year when everyone's buying them. We have one that we would recommend over against the Left Behind series or the Da Vinci Code. It's our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April. It's called They Will See His Face. It's authored by a regular guest here on Issues, Etc., Dr. Richard Iyer. It's about worship and healing. It's about what God does for us in worship as he dispenses the forgiveness of sins won at the cross by his son Jesus Christ. They Will See His Face is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it from Concordia Publishing House. You still have about 25 minutes to do it, or any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can go online, browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find the book, They Will See His Face, Worship and Healing. Concordia Publishing House also has two locations in the St. Louis area, one at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis, the other here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, 801 DeMunn is the address, or just head into the heart of Clayton, and sooner or later you'll run into Concordia Seminary and find Concordia Publishing House's bookstore. There, look for They Will See His Face when you go in, when you call, when you write, mention Issues, etc. It's our Issues, etc. book of the month for April. This is a must-read if you consider yourself a combatant, an observer in the worship wars. They Will See His Face. It's open lines for your questions and your comments. The 12th in the Left Behind series came out last week. It's titled Glorious Appearing. I imagine those who have been reading all the previous 11 have waiting with bated breath. What are they going to do when Jesus finally shows up? Two things to note of irony before we hear from Tim LaHaye, the co-author of this long series. It's about time Jesus gets some play in these novels. I mean, after all, that's what this is all supposed to be about, his second coming. But remember, for Jerry Jenkins and Tim LaHaye, who have put together the Left Behind novels, Jesus' glorious appearing here depicted in this latest bestseller that came out last week is only the first of his comings. Actually, he came once, incarnate in human flesh, through the womb of the Virgin Mary. They would not deny that. This is his second coming. They also have a third coming. Well, no, this would be his third coming, wouldn't it? His second coming came at the beginning of the series of novels when he came back halfway, raptured the church in a secret rapture that didn't stay secret, 7 years, 12 novels, and then he comes back again finally and establishes the millennial kingdom. That is a subject, apparently, of a future book, 1,000 years in one book. We'll hear from LaHaye on that subject here in just a moment. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's hear from co-author of this popular series, the Left Behind series, Tim LaHaye. He says that Glorious Appearing, the latest, is already a bestseller.
The whole first printing of almost 2 million copies has been sold out. They made a second printing, but they made a mistake of only printing 50,000, and they've all been spoken for. And so now they've raised it to 100,000 more. So they may have two or three more printings before the first month.
So we're talking about 2 million sold already, or at least in some way sold already, and headed toward 3 million of this latest in the best-selling series, The Left Behind series, from Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins. LaHaye says that Glorious Appearing carries the Left Behind characters that everyone has become so familiar with in the previous 11 novels through the second coming of Christ.
Some of them die and go to be with Christ and come back with the armies of heaven, and they'll be in their supernatural bodies. Others will endure the tribulations, and they'll go into the millennial kingdom in their natural bodies.
Okay, so we get to meet all the old characters that people have become fond of in the previous 11 novels. Tim LaHaye says that Glorious Appearing begins, at least according to their timeline of the end times, at the Battle of Armageddon, and ends with Jesus ruling the entire world.
It'll just start the millennium. We're leaving that open, you know, as historical prophetic marketeers. Why, we're thinking if we could get 12 books out of the 7-year tribulation period, just think how many books we could get out of the 1,000-year millennium.
Now, I'm wondering about that because according to Jenkins' scheme, which is not unique to Jenkins or LaHaye, about the end times, it's just kind of boilerplate dispensational premillennialism. According to this scheme, that 1,000-year reign of Christ won't make much of a novel. I mean, it's going to be a time where there is no sin by force of law. Jesus is basically going to be enforcing among believers and unbelievers, those in their resurrected bodies and those who are still in their regular bodies, those who believe and those who don't, perfect righteousness for 1,000 years. Now, LaHaye says that the novel Glorious Appearing does conclude the Left Behind series, because, of course, you can't really talk about being left behind anymore after this event in the novel, but there is more.
We're also going to come out with a prequel that will start in Rayford Steele's kitchen and show the events of rapture from the inside as Irene Steele and her son are raptured up and meet his parents and so on. Then we have the sequel, and that'll be when we decide what we're going to do with the millennium, probably tie it all together with just one book.
Okay, a prequel. This started, do you remember when the maker of the Star Wars films started this midstream back in 1977, I think it was? And then when they decided and they had all the technology together to make other Star Wars films, they did the prequel. And we're working our way up to the time that we watched back in 1977. Well, you know, if it works well for the Star Wars saga, it works just as well for the Left Behind series that claims to be based upon biblical truth. So they'll make a prequel. Rayford Steele, the main character in these novels, the hero, well, we'll get his what's going on with Rayford Steele before the rapture? What's his life like there? And then they're going to decide later what to do with the Millennium. On that note, LaHaye says that he and Jerry Jenkins do plan to write that sequel that will depict Jesus' thousand-year reign. Here's what he has to say.
Jerry says the problem with that is there won't be any conflict between good and evil, and you have to have that in every fiction book one way or another. And there won't be possible. Can you imagine a time when it won't be possible to sin or break the law? That Christ will be in rigid control, establishing a reign of righteousness.
Christ will be in rigid control. See, this is the end of the dispensational viewpoint, if I could just wax theological for a moment. This is the end game for the... This is not a kingdom of grace that Christ establishes here at the end, the thousand-year reign of Christ, according to the dispensationalists. It's a kingdom of power. It's a kingdom of force. Christ is in rigid control. People aren't sinning not because they're not sinners anymore, but because they fear Christ. This is Christ's totalitarian rule for 1,000 years. I mean, there's no other way to put it. I don't know how he's going to enforce this. I mean, maybe he just zaps people who cross the line. But they picture the thousand-year reign of Christ not only as a literal thousand-year earthly reign, but also as one in which, well, Jesus is basically the ultimate despot. Very different from what Scripture depicts as the end game of the end times, which is Christ reigning according to his grace. And if you read the Bible correctly, you will understand that he's already doing that in forgiveness and mercy. His end game is not totalitarian despotism. His end game is the forgiveness and salvation of sinners. Now, LaHaye does answer the question, what kind of a future there is for the Left Behind movies? No, the first two, you've seen them? Wish you didn't? LaHaye says that Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion, gives him some hope for future movie prospects.
Oh, yes. It opens the door to the film area. That was one of my longtime dreams. I was frustrated by the schlocking job the folks did on the little Mickey Mouse videos they put out on our first books. Hopefully, if we get the rights to that back, we'll be able to have it done right, and Mel Gibson will have paved the way.
Now, Mel Gibson figures into this a little bit more. We'll hear from LaHaye in just a moment. But look, you can make a lot of money with 12 novels in a row. You can make a lot of money. But if you really want to rake in the dough, I am not saying this is LaHaye's intention, but certainly the people who are working with him. He talked about the marketeers before. They have their eyes on a much bigger brass ring than just pulling in book sales. Movies really make the money. There's your bang for the buck. I mean, and Gibson's movie has proven that if you're willing to put out a little bit and sacrifice a little bit, as LaHaye will observe, you can reap the benefits, so to speak. LaHaye says he would like to cast Mel Gibson himself in a big-budget film.
Pray for me in that regard. The minute the court says that we have the rights back for our first book, Jerry and I are committed. We're going to go to Mel Gibson and ask him if he'd be Rayford Steele.
Now, I had not heard this, but apparently the rights for the Left Behind series, the film rights, do not belong to Jenkins and LaHaye at this point, but they're challenging those who hold the rights and trying to get them back so they can make these movies. Pastor LaHaye says that he and co-author Jenkins would like Gibson to portray none other than the hero, Rayford Steele.
Well, we may just be surprised to see that with his commitment to faith, he may say, hey, I'd like to do that. That's the kind of thing I'd like to be known for, is making that kind of impact on the future.
The only problem there, I think, and here I'm making several judgment calls. One, that I don't believe Mel Gibson, if he's consistent in his Catholic beliefs, buys into the dispensational view of the end times. And two, whether or not Gibson would be willing at this point to make a film depicting a character in a scenario that he doesn't believe in, that is supposedly based on biblical truth. I doubt both of those things. Catholics, by and large, are, as Lutherans and the majority of Christians throughout history and even today, not dispensational, but amillennial. They believe that Christ's reign begins at the cross and the resurrection and the ascension, and that it lasts not a literal 1,000 years here on earth, but forever and into eternity, including his single and second coming, not a bunch of little comings and half comings and secret raptures. But finally, LaHaye says he doesn't think that Gibson has actually read the Left Behind novels yet.
No, I don't think so. But I know that he's been confronted with my other fiction book, Babylon Rising, and he may be thinking, or his company may be thinking of doing that kind of a film. I really don't know, but I know that it's at the point where script's been written and a proposal will be made soon.
So we'll be looking for this. We'll see whether or not we'll be looking for... Maybe they've... If he thinks that the first Left Behind series of novels were, as he said, Mickey Mouse productions, he might want to go back and redo it with Kirk Cameron. Was that the guy who was the Rayford Steele character? Gibson does have a bigger box office draw, and maybe he wants to remake it in a way more fitting to the budgets that he's become accustomed to. LaHaye says that the success of Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ film is a breakthrough for Christian films.
The door is now open for good, faith-based, quality movies. Mel Gibson was willing to put $30 to $35 million on the line, and he said, he told me himself, if I lose it, I don't care. This is something I've got to do. And with that passion behind it, God has overflowed him with all kinds of blessing.
The only difference, Pastor LaHaye, is that when Mel Gibson decided to make a film, faith-based quality film, as Pastor LaHaye calls it, he didn't Mickey Mouse around in a bunch of cockamamie theories about the end times that have only been around for, at the very most, 100 years or 150 years. He went straight to the heart of the Christian faith and made a film about what really makes Christians Christian and what really matters. The real Jesus, not some Jesus of dispensational figments and imaginations. The real Jesus, the real suffering, crucified, and risen Savior. That's the difference. So, I don't know. Maybe the agents will work that one out. Maybe that can become a contractual compromise if Gibson's going to play Rayford Steele. I'd like your reaction to Tim LaHaye, what he had to say, or if you have a question or a comment on the Left Behind novels or End Times teaching, here's your opportunity. Give us a call during open lines, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It is open lines for the next 45 minutes of the program. We're coming to you live this Monday. It's the 5th. Of April, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or as usual, anything you want to talk about, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Okay, we've been pretty hard on Rick Warren's book, The Purpose-Driven Life, and I'm not retracting a single syllable of what's been said here on the air, or a single jot or tittle of what I have written in public about The Purpose-Driven Life. It all stands. But I've said from the beginning that this is our critique of The Purpose-Driven Life, and Warren's book there is in no way a critique of the man himself. I mean, his theology is bogus, but the man himself, by all accounts and by everything I have ever looked into, is a devout Christian man, a sincere Christian man. And just as it is incumbent upon us to criticize his latest theological offerings to the Christian reading world, it's also incumbent to commend him when commendations are in order. I read most recently in Christianity Today, and I read for you as well, the author of the bestseller, The Purpose-Driven Life, will delay the release of his newest book for at least 1 year. Tentatively titled Healing Choices, executives at Howard Publishing, that little publishing house put on the map by The Purpose-Driven Life, along with Rick Warren and co-author John Baker, decided to hold the release of the book that was due in bookstores in August. Quote, Rick's wife has been ill with cancer, many of you know this, and the growth of Saddleback Church, his congregation out there at Lake Forest, California, has exploded. Greg Petrie, vice president of marketing, said, with all that going on in Rick's and John's life, he has a lot more material that he wants to put into the book, and he has a lot more life experiences. He wants to draw these from new life experiences, a more current, more relevant book The publisher, by the way, of The Purpose-Driven Life and the forthcoming book that's been put on hold, isn't planning to shelve Warren's follow-up to The Purpose-Driven Life indefinitely. Quote, "We're certainly not going to wait too long. It's too important to all of us," Petrie said. He expects the marketing of the book to exceed $300,000. Seems like a small figure, though. The Purpose-Driven Life is on its 62nd week in the New York Times bestsellers list and has sold nearly 13 million copies. In the article on the postponement yesterday, Publishers Weekly called Warren one of the hottest authors around right now. Now, if you know the publishing world, you strike while the iron is hot. You don't wait. But I must commend Rick Warren for waiting. I can guarantee you his publishers aren't saying, "Rick, wait." They're saying, "Come on. We've got a manuscript. Clean it up. We want to get this out because this is money in the bank." It certainly is money in the bank. It's a no-brainer. But I must commend Rick Warren, with an ailing wife sick with cancer, that he is attending to his vocation as a husband before his vocation, far more lucrative and promising in the eyes of the world, as an author of bestsellers. Now, because he's a commendable man and obviously has his priorities straight, he's taken all of the proceeds from The Purpose-Driven Life. He's paid back his congregation 20 years of salary. He is not taking any of the royalties from the book for himself. Because he's a commendable Christian man doesn't mean that his theology is commendable. So as I said before, the critique of The Purpose-Driven Life stands. Every syllable spoken here on the air and written by me stands. But when someone deserves commendation here, we'll give it out. So kudos to Rick Warren. In a new study that's been released very recently, the typical Protestant church, their Sunday service in the United States is apparently becoming increasingly modernized and diversified in recent years as more churches incorporate non-traditional music, diverse styles of worship, and modern technologies into their worship experience. Now, this is not an overwhelming trend. This is just a trend that seems to be on the rise. A new report in a study released in the March and April editions of Facts and Trends magazine shows that there's been a significant increase in contemporary worship styles in American Protestant churches over the last 5 years. While 44% of churches surveyed report no significant change, 15% said that their church has moved in a more contemporary direction, while another 36% said that their worship had become a little more contemporary. Only 5% said that their worship had become more traditional during this time period. Now, this is just the trend. This is just an observation of the trend. Doesn't mean it's a good thing. Doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing, although if you've listened to this program for more than about 15 minutes, you know where I stand on that. Larger churches and churches led by younger ministers are most likely to have a significant shift toward more contemporary styles, and Pentecostal churches, were about twice as likely to move in that direction as others, 31% of them as opposed to 12% among other Protestant churches. One of the biggest changes found was the use of electronic media. 5 years ago, only 5% of all Protestant churches used PowerPoint or similar computer graphics at least once a month. Today, 36% of churches use projected computer graphics, and a similar figure reported the use of video clips, music videos, and video clips of well-known speakers during their worship services. The proportion of Protestant churches using praise and worship choruses during worship rose from 38% in 1999 to 74% today. That is a trend worth noting. The use of drama, skits, sketches has risen from 23% to 42%, and the use of Christian rock, pop, or country music in worship rose from 9% 5 years ago to 25% today. Although, you know, strictly speaking, in terms of the modern culture, you can't call any of that stuff rock, pop, or, well, maybe country. Country is one of those things that doesn't change so much. Not since Garth Brooks changed it for good. The old hand country people would not call Shania Twain and Garth Brooks country. They would call them something else. Cowboy hat wearing pop singers, probably. Country wannabe, pick up driving millionaires. I don't know. Call them anything you want to. But strictly speaking, in most churches, what passes for contemporary pop or rock is just easy listening. It's just adult contemporary easy listening pillow talk kind of music. It might have a slight rock beat to it and might employ the same instruments, but it's pretty much what I used to call when I was a kid and listening to real rock and roll, elevator music. Real rock and roll being actually rock and roll. 95% of churches pass an offering plate. That hasn't changed. That hasn't changed. I wouldn't expect it to change either. The length of the pastor's sermon is unchanged. That's one of the things that hasn't changed. The average length the minister preaches, 31 minutes. 31 minutes. I had someone write me recently and say, why do you Lutherans preach such short sermons? I said, I do not know. Because if you go back 100 years in Lutheran churches, we were some of the windiest preachers, some of the longest preachers. It was not unusual for a 45-minute sermon to be considered a short sermon. To people walk out of service after 2 hours and say, well, that was hardly worth my time. I got into a horse and buggy and rode 2 hours to get here, and the pastor only preaches an hour? For heaven's sakes. Nowadays, Lutherans and Methodists have the shortest of sermons, the average length around 20 minutes, the longest sermons being preached among Pentecostals, about 40 minutes on average. But those figures have not changed. Now, I'm thinking about this as I'm reading this press release from Trends and Facts magazine about the changes that are taking place in the church. And I always want to ask the question, well, there are two questions on either end of the facts. One is why the changes? The general rationale is, well, what used to work doesn't work and we're going to do something different now. Now, note, it's simply a statement. There's no actual argument put forth for why what used to work doesn't work anymore. It's just simply declared to be the case, and therefore that's enough justification to change. That answers the why question. The other question on the other end of the facts is, what does this mean? What will this mean? Let's deal with the first question when we come back from this break. Pastors, generally speaking, you may not be aware of this, but pastors, generally speaking, tend to think that these kind of changes in their presentation, in their sermon style, in their worship style, are wanted by the people far more than the people think they're wanted. It's all being done because the people want this, but pastors tend to way, way, way overestimate how much the people want these changes. I have a few facts to back up that statement when we come back from this break. It's Open Lines, Issues, Etc., 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We heard earlier from Tim LaHaye with the release of The Glorious Appearing. Have you read it? Have you bought it? Did you spend the weekend glued to the pages of Jenkins and LaHaye's latest novel? I'd like your reaction to it as well. Open Lines for 25 minutes after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.